Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. 12 minutes after 9 o'clock, time to begin this morning's panel discussion on topics in the news. Today we're joined by our own Alan Shartok. Good morning.
How'd you do?
And our associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning.
You know, every night lately I've been going to bed praying that this topic will not be a topic tomorrow. But here it is today, and it's the same topic as yesterday.
This is like the Groundhog Day movie.
Yeah, it's the government shutdown, boys and girls. And guess what? As near as I can tell, House Republicans can't find their heads from their yes, yes, yes. And House Democrats, unwilling to even give them a little to save their heads and their yes, yes, yes. And here we are today on the verge of a default. Same deal. Republicans in the House can't do anything. Start with you, Alan.
Well, I'm not only interested in what's happening, but I'm fascinated by what the American people are doing with all of this. Yesterday on Vox Pop, we raised the subject, right?
Yeah.
Usually the phones are just filled. Mm-hmm. Boom. I had to sort of cajole them, the group, the audience at the calling. Well, once I said, how come nobody cares about this? Every phone lit up, you know, and people would give ideas ranging from the strange to the great, and there they were. But I think a lot of people are either sensing that this is a bunch of baloney, or there's nothing, they're not empowered to do anything about it, and are just sort of as individual. I mean, when I say there, I mean the voters, and they have nothing to do. Yeah.
Well, let me before we go to Mike, let me get you up to speed this morning on what there is as by way of development. This is from the other newspaper of record, the New York Times. The first one being, of course, the Times Union. This is debt talks in disarray as House balks. Jonathan Wiseman. With the federal government on the brink of default, a House Republican effort to end the shutdown and extend the Treasury's borrowing authority collapsed Tuesday night, that's last night, as a major credit agency warned that the U.S. was on the verge of a costly ratings downgrade. We've been this route before. After the failure of the House Republican leadership to find enough support for its latest proposal to end the fiscal crisis, the Senate's Democratic and Republican leaders immediately restarted negotiations to find a bipartisan path forward. And Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, they're, quote, optimistic that an agreement is within reach. However, despite John McCain saying, look, it's very, very serious, Republicans have to understand we've lost this battle and we have to do something. And it's still a question whether, if the Senate comes through with something today, the House will say yes. Mike Spain.
Well, mechanically, the Senate would have to expedite it, and they have mechanisms to do that.
Right? Yeah, but they're still saying it could take up to a day if somebody wants to throw a monkey wrench in.
Right, if Ted Cruz steps forward or that fellow from Utah. But the essentially, whether or not bipartisan, I mean, you know, I disagree with something you said earlier. I mean, the one difference is there is growing bipartisan support in the Senate for this. This isn't going to be a Democrats all in favor and Republicans against in the Senate. The Democrats gave in on, you know, the tax on medical devices, and they're adding some safeguards to make sure that people who are ineligible for Obamacare don't get it, you know, et cetera.
I mean, but that's the Senate. The House is the issue here.
Right. But I mean, so Democrats and Republicans are kind of doing what they're supposed to do. They're making painful compromises so that they can get this thing along. The question is whether it will be put up to a full vote in the House.
In the meantime, the Chinese have had a say. Go ahead.
Well, no, go ahead. What did they say?
Well, the Chinese are saying they have, I think, a trillion and a third, details.
Treasury bonds.
Yeah, of our bonds. And they're saying that this country is putting people at risk and coming up with a solution, which is that instead of having the dollar controlling everything in the world, there should be an international fund of some kind, which will be the currency.
Well,
ain't going to happen.
This is the political ploy. I mean, they've been wanting that, and they carp about that from time to time over the years. So every time there's an advantage to say something like that, they're going to say it. Yeah, I wouldn't be too worried about that.
But I mean, I'm not an expert in this and international monetary issues, but I think there are enough reputable people who are saying that this can have a lasting effect on the prominence of the U.S. dollar on the international stage. And, you know, it's not going to change it instantly, but over time, these kinds of things, if they continue to happen, can backfire. And the, you know, the U.S. enjoys a great economic advantage by having its currency being the dominant currency.
You are such a smart man. Well, you're right.
Well, I, you know, I listen to NPR and I read the
right
time.
He's, okay. He's right.
Yeah. Well, why don't you compliment each other until break? We got a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
No. But the House is real interesting because they go into conference. Boehner comes up with a solution in which he claims that they've gotten a few things, as Mike just mentioned, the medical device and some other things, and we're going to do it, and we're only going to do it till February, and he cannot get them to agree on anything. He can't get his right-wingers or his moderates. They just can't agree on anything, and that doesn't make them look good.
No, and the question, I think a week ago when we were talking about this, and probably 2 weeks ago and every other day in between.
Hopefully not next week.
Right. Was whether, if it went to a full House vote, there would be enough Republicans who would join Democrats to pass this. And is that at issue right now?
Well, there are many people, including the NPR chief political analyst who was on this morning, who was saying there's no doubt if it goes to the full House— it's going to pass. And with Democratic, and he said there are more than enough, and those were the exact words, mm-hmm. more than enough Republican votes to go along with it.
Well, then let me ask you this, just as a lesson of political science. Is it strictly that Boehner is not, he has the authority to bring it to a full vote?
Yes, he does.
And
but
he
does
not,
he want to lose his seat?
Right.
What does
and
he
is
want
that
to lose
what this
his
is
job?
About?
It is partially about that. The other issue there, as we've been talking about, is that his moderates in the House are loath to let him go because next up are Cantor and Ryan, who are not moderates. They are righties. And that is a tough one to let Boehner down. And I think that there's a whole school that thinks what's going on here is to get rid by the Tea Party people is to get rid of Boehner.
Right. And it may achieve that goal, but if are there enough votes for Ryan or for Cantor to become the majority leader?
It's a very interesting question. You know, what happens is these guys have so much immense power, particularly when they're in the majority in terms of all the pork and everything else that goes around, that you don't want to mess with it because it means that you may not get that bridge or you may not get what you need in your district or you may be relegated to a committee you don't want to be on.
Right. So a lot of deals will be being made
sure.
between Cantor Which, and some moderates so that he can get their support, et cetera. Right.
Yeah. You look perplexed.
Well, no, I had a question. Yeah. If we take it as you have written that there are enough moderate Republican votes along with the Democrats to get it through the House.
Yes.
Then wouldn't it be not a huge leap to say that, you know, the ultra conservative Republicans would have a tough time if Boehner were out? Than getting the lead role?
Yeah, no, I think it's very perplexing to me. I don't quite understand why Boehner leans to the right as opposed to the much larger moderate group. I don't get it. But I do know one thing, that somewhere in life there is something called a profile in courage model, a John Kennedy's book model, in which, you know, Boehner says, I'm sorry, I'm not going to let my country go down.
Okay.
Right. Many before him have done that. So if he lets a full House vote happen and it does pass as everyone would anticipate, he's toast.
Well, I'm not even sure of that when it all comes down.
Mm-hmm. And then you have the credit agencies. There are three big ones, and the third biggest is Fitch Ratings. They're now applying their own form of pressure, saying, you know— we're taking a step toward a potential downgrade of the AAA rating that we have. They warned of political brinksmanship and reduced financing flexibility. Those threats really didn't carry a lot of weight the last time. But
well,
eventually
also,
something
but
will have
money.
To give.
I mean, it costs the government, it costs us, the taxpayers, a lot more money to borrow money. And, you know, what is the estimate? $300 million a day that the shutdown is costing. So you add that to the cost of higher interest in borrowing when we have when we can't pay our bills and we default technically.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just making the deficit worse, which is what nobody wants.
Well, none of those ratings agencies really want trouble. The last time, the last time they did it, mm-hmm. And we were downgraded. Which one? I forget which one. Moody's, I think. Did it. There were congressional investigations threatened. Yeah,
there were. And there was some talk that there was some retaliation involved. So I'll tell you what, let's take a break. Mike Spain from the Times Union is here. Alan Shartok, our own political observer. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. It's the Roundtable. And, of course, Sarah Palin has a thing or two to say. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Support for WMC comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst. Since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Springbrook, Oneonta, New York. Supporting people of all ages with developmental disabilities, working in schools, in homes, and in communities across New York to help individuals achieve independence. SpringbrookNY.org. Clear Yoga in Rhinebeck. Iyengar Yoga for all ages and abilities, beginner, advanced, and special needs. Classes daily, including restorative, meditation, and weekend workshops. ClearYogaRhinebeck.com. And Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. A community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment. Berkshire.coop.
Once again, it's the Roundtable on WAMC, almost midway through our morning panel discussion. 9:23 is the time. Mike Spain from the Times Union is here. Alan Shartok is here, and I'm Ray Graff. And we have something via the email, Alan?
No, but I just wanted to remind everybody that they can let us know.
All right. You held up your iPad. I thought you
Well, that was a signal to you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't picking up your brainwaves this morning.
Oh, yeah. Well,
you write me a note.
Just a signal to you that that people should let us know that,
okay,
what they think.
Oh, that's a good point. Roundtable at WAMC.org is the email, and that's the quick way to get in touch. Thank you for reminding me this, sir. I appreciate that very much. All right, so the...
We did hear from Julius.
Surprisingly.
No, Julius writes us, and he's a very bright guy.
Okay.
He says, so some Republicans are admitting they overreached on this argument, and the Democrats should give them some, quote, help in getting out of this dilemma gracefully. How many times and when have Republicans done that for Democrats? Julius.
All right, Julius. I don't know. I'd have to look that up. All right, so in the meantime, you have another angle here, and I thought this was interesting. This was from, where did I see this? CBS?
I think it's the CBS affiliate
in Washington, D.C. Yeah. Okay, here we go. Quoting, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin believes President Obama should be impeached if he raises the debt ceiling without the backing of Congress. In a Facebook post, that's where all the politics is done now, Palin said Obama is, quote, scaremongering the markets on the prospect of default if the nation's borrowing limit doesn't rise by October 17th. Default on our national debt is an impeachable offense, and any attempt by President Obama to unilaterally raise the debt limit without Congress is also an impeachable offense. Palin said a default would also be a shameful lack of leadership, just as mindlessly increasing our debt without trying to rein in spending is a betrayal of our children and grandchildren who will be stuck with the bill. Gentlemen, weigh in.
So if he does unilaterally try to raise the debt ceiling, that's an impeachable offense.
Right.
But by not achieving an agreement with the Congress, that's an impeachable offense.
Yeah, I think the writing's on the wall there.
Well,
right?
You know, Cynthia Tucker, who's a respected nationally syndicated columnist, the Times Union does pick up her column frequently, had a column this week that just talked about how there's a segment of people out there who still really don't accept Obama as their legitimate president. And they're still really angry about it. It's kind of like the people after Bush. Bush 2, George W. Bush won in the year 2000 in the disputed election. There were people who felt that was an illegitimate conclusion by the Supreme Court, and they never really were willing to accept George W. Bush as the president. And yet most people said, okay, it is what it is. The court of the land has made its decision. We don't agree with it, but we're going to go forward and we're going to do what we can.
And what choice do we have?
And what choice do you have? Yeah.
But
and
there are those who also think, not to tangentialize this.
Which is something you never do.
Yeah, but there are also that there may be a tinge of racism here.
Oh, I believe she said that. I mean, you know, she talked about how outside the White House, you know, people picket with effigies of Obama that are actually monkeys.
Yeah, and Civil War flags.
And Civil War flags, right, Southern flags from the Civil War. You know, and for people today, you know, to still harbor that is pretty disgraceful. And yet it fuels a broader contempt. I mean, there's people who just hate Obama because they don't agree with his policy.
Right, and to be clear, you're not painting Sarah Palin as a racist, right?
Well, I have not accused her of being a racist, I'm saying her position...
What do you mean good?
Well, you don't want to do that without running it through legal. I mean, clearly, you don't want to do that.
Let me make a call.
Yeah.
No,
said the owl.
What I was going to say was that Sarah Palin's, you know, sort of absurd position that he should be impeached if we raise the debt ceiling and he should be impeached if we don't raise the debt ceiling just shows that she's one of those people who are unable to accept Obama as president. And I think there are a lot of people who are, some of whom based in racism and some just because they buy the rhetoric.
Yeah.
Or that they just say, well, it's, you know, perhaps this is just too far left. And, there are those who are so far right, they say, well, we can't go on like this.
Yeah, but what's really going on here is that Palin is reaching out to the uber right in the same way that the 30 guys in the Tea Party are doing that, not wanting to have primaries. Palin probably thinks in her own mind that she is still a viable candidate for national office.
Or a viable candidate for a nationally syndicated television program.
Which she didn't do very well with when she was on the Fox, right?
I don't know. I don't think I ever saw it. She was on the Fox? She had her own show?
She had a reality show, too, on TLC or
did
something.
Did she?
Yeah, she shot animals.
I only have one thing to say. Mm-hmm. Look over there. What do you see coming?
Yeah.
The Russians.
Okay, so it's the roundtable on WAMC. Some dramatic foreshadowing. In the next half hour, we'll talk about Supreme Court to hear the challenge to the EPA rules on gas emissions. We'll also talk about strip clubs and is stripping art. And there is the Supreme Court says, well, we don't want this in our lap. And
that's funny, Ray.
Ba-dum-bum. Thank you very much. And the Moreland panel. Making moves in New York State. All that coming up on the roundtable. Mike Spain is here. Alan Chartok is here. I'm Ray Graff. More on the way. Welcome back to the roundtable on WAMC. The time is 9:36. The Times Union's Mike Spain is here. Alan Chartok is here. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. If you want to join in the conversation, feel free to email us, roundtable@wamc.org. And Alan, I guess we got a few.
Why, yes, Ray, you're right.
Okay, Roger called. Roger wrote and said several references so far to whether the House Democrats would be willing to help House GOP pass a debt ceiling bill. In fact, House Dems are ready and willing. Boehner, not willing to bring to the floor any bill that lacks majority GOP support. House Dems do not share any blame for this, Roger. And then Gary called and said, Gary wrote, and a long thing, financial calamity is upon us, whether or not Congress prevails in doing the right thing. Passing legislation to raise the debt ceiling, damage has been done to our nation's credibility, and he writes a lot more, but unfortunately we don't have
take the rest of the show. Yeah.
Okay. And Brian, since the speaker is chosen in a non-partisan vote of the entire House, if there are enough Democrat and moderate Republican votes to pass a clean continuing budget resolution, why wouldn't there be enough votes to keep Boehner in as speaker? I keep asking that question.
Okay.
I think it's a profound question.
So maybe Brian. He is not. I mean, everyone says the conventional wisdom is that his position is weakening and weak, and perhaps that's not the case.
Yeah. Well, look, as I said yesterday, I've been around a long time. I've seen a lot of weak sisters. That's a bad word.
Yeah, that is a bad word.
I take it back.
All right.
Listen.
Hang on. I just missed the 7-second delay. I could have saved you that.
Okay. but weak people, as the head of these minorities and majorities, and the legislators always keep them there because they figure, okay, better a weak person than a strong person, and somebody, and when that guy's done, I'll come next. Okay. And then Terry takes a shot. Since the speaker is chosen in a non... Oh, no, that's wrong. Terry says... the House Republicans changed the rule, only allow the majority leader of the House to bring a clean CR bill to the floor for a vote. But he refuses to do it because he knows it would pass. And these in capital letters. Why isn't this all over the news, including WAMC?
It is.
Will you please? I mean, will you please? Okay, give me a break here.
Okay. All right.
John Sullivan. Seems to me that the Tea Party Republican congressman would have been more in sync with themselves had they sung "Nearer to My God to Thee," remembering the Titanic, instead of Amazing Grace.
Oh, that's funny.
Although Amazing Grace is usually sung at funerals.
All right. Well, that's very clever. And that's
that was
one.
Clever.
And the email address, once again, is roundtable@wamc.org. Okay, from the pages of the Times Union, Big news here around the state capitol in Albany. The great Casey Seiler writes an article entitled "Moreland Panel Ready Subpoenas for State Lawmakers." First Graph says, in a development that could cast a chill over the 2014 legislative session, Governor Cuomo's Moreland Commission on Public Corruption will issue subpoenas in pursuit of more information about state lawmakers' outside income before, and I suspect Alan might have a few things to say about this. Before we do that, let's have Mike just get us up to speed.
Right.
Mike's
to the
paper.
Latest
well, as Casey Seiler reports today, just last week, it looked like the Moreland Act panel that's investigating corruption in state government was about to throw in the towel. And they were chastised by many editorial boards and a lot of commentators, including one that's in this studio right now, for basically backing off.
Not me.
Yeah, yes. And we'll hear that soon. But essentially now they are going to issue subpoenas. They did ask in a letter that the state legislators list their outside business activities if it was up to a certain threshold. Many legislators are lawyers, and they have clients who may or may not be doing business with the state, which could pose a conflict of interest. And the commission wanted to see that. They wanted to air that and get that out in the public.
So that was an ask, but not a
tell. It was an
tell.
Ask, and the ask was, the answer was no.
Okay.
Now these are, many of these guys and women are attorney general, district attorneys in counties around New York State.
Sure.
And the state attorney general, Eric Schneiderman, has deputized them as deputy state attorney general, so they do have this extra subpoena power. Some are saying that they don't have the power, and traditionally a Moreland Act panel does not have subpoena power, so it could end up in the courts. But it, as Casey said...
No, just let me correct you.
Yes.
They do have subpoena power,
right,
but not on the legislative branch, because these are separate branches of government.
Right.
Go ahead.
And Casey points out that this could make for a very sticky relationship between the executive branch and the legislative branch.
Like we don't have that already.
In the 2014 session. So there you have it. It's going to, the legislators are going to get subpoenas, and they're going to be having to decide where to go and what to do.
Okay, so here's my take. Here's my imagination.
Okay.
This is all imagination.
All right.
Here's a governor sitting in a room. He says, okay, boys, we're going to have a Moreland Act commission. He doesn't know that eventually the $29 million that he's got in the bank is going to get investigated. Then we hear from people like the Daily News, Ken Lovett, that they're calling, and substantiated by the Times Union, that they're calling in the plays and they're saying, don't subpoena this one, don't subpoena the real estate industry, and don't subpoena this or that. Then the next thing we hear is that they're saying now, okay, that the Moreland Act Commission, we think we're done, we're just going to throw the whole thing in, and we're going to recommend a constitutional amendment, parenthesis, that will never pass, and we're going to fold our cards and go away. And then there must have been a tremendous feedback from the press. The New York Times, everybody else were writing articles and saying, basically, this is no good.
You may have written something yourself.
I did. I wrote a column myself on that. It's in what? So then what happens is there is a pushback from them, and then all of a sudden they're going for it. They're really, as Mike has just said, they're really going for it. There are subpoenas flying all over the place. And if it goes to this New York State Court of Appeals, I'm telling you right now, that Court of Appeals is not going to say you don't have that power to the... it is Alan Chartok who is telling you that Court of Appeals is going to side in the interest of getting full disclosure, number one, and getting people to understand how corrupt this government is. And I'm telling you now, they're going to do it. They better not look to the court, because the court's not going to help in the legislature.
There could be a compromise. And this could be flexing a muscle. State Senator Neil Breslin, in the last week, had proposed a compromise. He's an attorney,
yep.
And he has clients whom he draws more than $20,000 in compensation, which is the threshold that the commission is setting for disclosure. And he has recommended a compromise where he gives the list of his clients to the committee, where essentially they will look at it confidentially,
yeah,
in camera, the way a judge, that's the term when
sure.
a judge will look at something. And if they find no conflict of interest, just they can assert that but keep the list confidential. If they find a problem and they feel they need to bring it out and pursue it, which suggests that he doesn't have anybody who's a problem there.
Okay, so he's you know? Clear.
Right, right. Yeah. So maybe that kind of will be emulated by others, and then the commission could verify that they found no glaring conflicts of interest, or they found this many, or et cetera, and maybe there would be something like this. So maybe this is their muscle. Now, the question, Alan, I wondered if you had thought about this. Now that they've decided to subpoena the legislators, do you think now that the commission will also turn around and subpoena the records of the property owners in New York City that won the big tax exemptions from the Cuomo administration to put up high-rise apartments?
No, I think that's certainly possible. And I think that's why, if Ken Lovett is correct at the Daily News, and if, in fact, the word went out from the governor's office, don't subpoena the real estate industry, you know, there may be a reason for that. Does that answer your question?
Well, it sounds like there's going to be a lot more interesting stories about the Moreland Act Commission just days after we thought it was done with it.
Yeah.
Mario Cuomo said to me, the great politicians can think six moves in advance.
Right.
It would appear to me now that the son of Mario has not thought six moves in advance on this issue.
Unless we are not thinking six moves in advance, and he is. I mean, we'll find out, yes?
I think that's an affirmative.
Yeah. I mean, perhaps he is.
I'm just shrugging my shoulders.
Okay. All right. It's the only time I've ever known you to be silent. So we'll just move on to the next topic. Tell you what, Hopper, let's take a break. It's the Roundtable on WAMC, and then back with stripping.
Support for WAMC comes from Third Eye Associates Limited, investment advisors with offices in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Red Hook, New York, life planning, transition planning, and wealth management, thirdeyeassociates.com. Topperson, natural medicine formula creams designed to heal muscles, joints, nerves, and skin conditions, including shingles and eczema, topperson.com. Mr. Rooter of the Hudson Valley, working to fix water leaks, sewer odors, old pipes, valves, toilets, sinks, sewer lines, water heaters, and septic systems, 845-635-2102. And Miss Hall School, a girls' boarding and day school in the Berkshires, grades 9 through 12, open house November 11th, campus tours, meet and greet, misshalls.org.
Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. 9:47 is the time. Albany Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is here. Also WAMC's Alan Shartok. I'm Ray Graff in today for Joe Donahue. The story from the Times Union. Strip club case won't be visiting Supreme Court. This is by Robert Gavin. The U.S. Supreme Court has declined to hear the case of whether dancing in strip clubs is art. The decision represents a significant setback to Stephen Dick Jr., owner of Night Moves, a nude club on Route 9 in Latham that pushed for the arguments. I hate it. W. Andrew McCulloch, the attorney for Dick's Club and a longtime adult industry lawyer, told the Times Union in a phone interview Tuesday, several hours after the high court declined to hear the case. Mike Spain, why don't you give us the details?
This goes back to a very interesting argument before the New York State's top court, the Court of Appeals, last year, where essentially the plaintiffs argued that they were unfairly being taxed and that they were a entertainment venue that provided dancing and art and therefore were exempt from the taxes that a strip club would ordinarily be required to pay. And this, we're talking about a lot of money. We're talking about $125,000 in taxes and now interest that the State Department of Taxation and Finance says that this club owes the state. And that is why they went to court. And it was a split decision.
It was a 4-3 decision.
It was a 4-3 decision.
Last October, I guess,
right,
a year ago?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it definitely could have gone either way with the U.S. Supreme Court.
I think it's a slippery slope mm-hmm. when you start saying that this is art and this isn't art. I mean, if you get somebody who considers herself or himself a dancer
right.
who stands up there and does something, what's the difference between between that and somebody wearing a tutu running across the stage of the Metropolitan Opera?
Which will be later on the roundtable. We'll have some ballet dancers on. Perhaps we can pose that question to them.
Sure. There's a lot of leg showing. There's a lot of this and that. One only questions whether or not when somebody says this is art or this isn't art, that sets a precedent for them doing that down the road.
Well, let's go back to the original
case. The power
to
tax is the power to destroy, you know. That's the Supreme Court of the United States. I believe it's McCullough versus Maryland, but I wouldn't want to bet on it.
Hmm. All right, let's go back to the original case from October of 2012. I don't know if you know the answer to this, Mike, but clubs in Albany and elsewhere that have rock music, right, they pay taxes.
Right,
yes?
But I think the thing that one of the factors that makes this different is they do not serve alcohol at this place. And they're licensed by the state liquor authority, so it kind of becomes entertainment. And then they charge pay sales tax, et cetera. And this the owners of this bar escape regulation by the state liquor authority by not serving alcohol. And by doing that, they claim that they are no different than a place where you might go see the ballet. And it's a compelling argument technically, but it's problematic for people who
live next door. I would be
or want $125,000 in tax revenue.
I would find it problematic if I lived next door. I mean, I don't think.
Well, nobody does. It's a commercial area in Latham.
Yeah, but I still think that there's a lot of arguments here about dehumanizing women and
that is all different stuff.
Yeah, that's a separate argument, yeah. Though. This is a tax argument.
No, but I'm giving you the comprehensive argument from the Chartakian perspective.
Okay, all right, feel free.
I've done it.
Oh, that's it?
People might claim that other entertainers are exploited by their handlers, you know, and are not in complete control of their, you know, what goes on. But, you know, it was such a compelling argument that it was by no means unanimous in the state of New York's top court.
Right.
Now, technically, because it was not taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court, it throws it back, and now their attorney for the bar, or the strip club, rather, not a bar,
no.
A strip club, is looking at other options and trying to find other avenues in which they can pursue it. But it looks pretty dismal. And, when Stephen Dick, the owner of this place, was interviewed on a national show back in October.
Who was that? What show was that?
It was Colbert Report.
Colbert, yeah.
Yes, he had a very humorous
version
of it,
right.
Because there were a lot of ironies to it. And that is a link to that is available on thetimesunion.com.
Nice little plug there, Mike Spanner. Right, moving on. We'll put the clothes back on. We'll
I would recommend it.
We'll go to these. Hey, we'll go to the Supreme Court once again. And this is from, again, the other newspaper of record, the New York Times. Supreme Court to hear challenge to EPA rules on gas emissions. The Supreme Court on Tuesday agreed to hear a major case challenging Environmental Protection Agency regulations of greenhouse gas emissions from stationary sources like power plants. The justices declined to hear a variety of related attacks on the agency's authority to address climate change. So this goes back to Massachusetts versus Environmental Protection Agency, which was a 2007 decision. It required the agency to regulate emissions of greenhouse gases from new motor vehicles if they found they endangered public health or welfare. This is the rule, if you will. And so this was then loosely interpreted to also favor stationary tailpipes, if you will, which would be smokestacks from power plants. And now it's to the Supreme Court.
Well, does anybody have any doubt about what's going on here? You got five conservative judges on there who tend to side with the industry and with other people to the right of center. And it's a very, very dangerous thing that they're doing here. Of course, every once in a while you get a case like this, and it prompts the Congress to do the right thing. In this case, is there anybody, hold up your hands, please, who's out there who believes that the Boehner Congress, House of Representatives, is going to, if the Supreme Court says, okay, you can't regulate these dangerous gases that we know are heating up the environment and the rest of it. I'm sorry, we do know that because of all the scientists and everybody who said it. Are we quite sure that the that the U.S. Congress, the House of Representatives, is going to meet in extraordinary session and change that real fast? We do not.
Well, far be it from me to even offer a gentle rebuke to you, the man who signs my paycheck. But I think that you are automatically assuming that the Supreme Court will make the decision that supports industry is not necessary. In other words, you can't predict. You predicted that Obamacare would be struck down, and it was not.
I don't remember predicting that.
Oh, I do. You said
I don't.
If an objective observer of the decisions by this current court, we're to look at them, the decisions. I think this should have environmentalists and people who favor the EPA having this authority. I think it should make them nervous because if they follow a pattern, this could be thrown out.
So that's 2-1, us against Ray.
No, all it means is...
I'm not even in it.
You were in it. And that with that scurrilous accusation, when I said, in fact, remembered very well, I feared that it would happen. That's not a prediction.
I see. Hmm. All right, revisionist history here on the round
table. No, maybe 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Attorney General of Texas...
At least I have the guts to do it.
...says the EPA violated the U.S. Constitution and the Federal Clean Air Act when it concocted greenhouse gas regulations out of whole cloth.
Right.
So I guess this gets down to the power of the EPA.
No, this gets down to the 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court.
I think we're talking about the same thing.
All right. Mike, you want to make some sense of this?
No, it's just that the fact that the court has, while they're not going to listen to the argument about the Latham strip bar, they are going to listen to something that has far more importance, which maybe is the right decision. And this case will be decided by the Supreme Court, and it could weaken the power of a very, very powerful, up till now, federal agency that has done a lot to regulate air quality and emissions in the U.S. And whether or not they'll continue to wield that power will be decided by 5 justices to 4. Right.
But, I mean, clearly this is a very limited case. In other words, this is not really throwing too much onto the EPA's ability to make these rules.
I disagree with that, Ray. I think what happens is if this one goes sailing through, it'll just encourage a lot more of this kind of thing.
All right. The roundtable here. And quickly, Alan, you sent this link to me. And maybe you can give us a quick 1 minute on it. Belafonte sues heirs of Martin Luther King Jr. It's from the New York Times.
You may remember, Ray, that we've done the series, this wonderful award-winning series on the great speeches in history. And one of them was the Martin Luther King speech. We asked the King family for permission to use the speech in its reality. We got to know, unless we paid a lot of money, as I remember it. And that means that...
You mean the audio of the speech.
The audio of the speech. And Belafonte is now saying that he owns all of these things. King was a very good friend of his. He stayed in his apartment all the time. And he gave him all of these things. And the King family saying, no, you don't owe them. Own them.
Right.
You don't
own them. There are three documents in question, one of which was given to Belafonte by Dr. King.
He says.
Well, the King family has historically been aggressive about protecting their ownership of their...
Can you imagine saying, Mike, that the greatest speech that may have ever been given in the United States doesn't belong to the public? I mean, right. I see it on television all the time. I don't know why we asked, but we did ask, and I see it as a news event all the time.
Right. I don't disagree with you at all, but the King family has been proprietary about the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. And, you know, for perhaps a very good reason, they want to control how he's presented in history, and they want to benefit from the...
Oh, I think this... what was the word you just used?
Benefit. Yeah, yes, I believe benefit is the legal term for getting paid for people to license various speeches and audio and video clips of Dr. Martin Luther King. And I think it's great that this is going to go to court, because I think it may settle it, and it might open up these rich archives to a broader
Harry Belafonte is one brave man. He always has been. Marched with Dr. King, was the first guy on the scene, arranged for all kinds of things to help the movement, and this is really going to set it up right.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this hour of the program. Thanks to Mike Spain of the Times Union. Mike, thank you for being here. We appreciate you
stepping in. Happy to be here.
Alan Chartok, once again, great to have you here on the program. You can join the conversation by emailing us at roundtable@wamc.org. Hour number two is on the way. You're listening to The Roundtable.